Hello.
Hey.
You're listening to Peninsula Obscura. I'm Karina Kolb.
And I'm Rachel Peacock.
This is a podcast about the strange and unusual state of Florida.
We'll talk about Florida's weird history,
paranormal activity,
and of course, true crime.
Each week, one of us researches a topic, and then we talk about it in depth.
Let's dive in.
Welcome.
Hi. Hiya.
Welcome back. Episode 31.
31. 31. And fun. Not really. In recent events and COVID and all of this injustice that is happening in our messed up country, Korean and I have, we feel that we need to share stories that people don't know about, and yeah, so that's what I just wanted to start off by saying.
Yeah, it's always been our goal, and the truth of the matter is that when it comes to Florida history, stories about people of color, indigenous people, immigrants, stories like that in Florida history are underreported, underwritten. You know, they're not the first thing that comes up when you Google it, and that's fine. We like to do research and, you know, obviously have done research on some of these stories. It's you know, a challenge that we're ready to face. I mean, you know, so, if anyone knows something that they're like, this story should really be told, let us know. Because, I mean, we're out here looking. I'm reading books and shit.
We really do want to show these stories because there's so much that can be learned from them, and so much history is, like Karina said, like swept under the rug and not told. And like living in the state of Florida, there's so many things that I don't know that Karina may not know that we tell each other stories every week in this podcast. But we think it's important that you guys know stories that are, they might be dark. There's definitely going to be some heavy episodes in the future. We've had some in the past, but it's
necessary. They've always been pretty dark.
They're always dark, but I think, yeah. Well, I mean, we like the I don't know. I can never say that word, but, you know.
Macabre.
Macabre. But this is more than just that. That is, I just, yeah, I feel more now than ever as individuals need to like learn about more history, and just, you know, our podcast lets us tell stories, so we're just gonna keep doing that.
I mean, and when it comes to like stories about the disenfranchised, like these are not our stories, and we have to go through the process of recognizing the lens at which we tell them, and I still think it's valuable for us to share them, even though they're not ours to share, I guess, because all we can do is amplify these.
Yes.
You know, this is stuff that if you Google it, you're not going to find it immediately.
Nope.
And I think that certain communities have taught these stories to each other, but others have purposefully removed those stories from the dialogue, so...
Yes, and I'd say that a lot of it, too, is as both of us have grown up in Florida, like, a lot of these stories that we talk about, they never talked about them in school.
Yeah.
You know, even in undergrad, there are few times, I guess, I didn't really take classes that are geared towards these stories, and I should have, but, you know, just educating myself and working towards reading more and looking up things and learning more about the areas that we've come from, like that is just something that everyone I feel like can do, especially if you're from Florida and other places, just because so much violence and so much has happened here. I'm excited that we get to tell these stories just because they're so interesting and you learn so much from them, and I hope that you guys feel move to look up your own stories, you know, tell your own stories. And even though I, like Karina said, this is not our stories, we just like sharing them with you guys. So we hope to continue to do that.
Yeah. I hope you enjoy it. On that note, last week we posted a picture to our Instagram from the Tallahassee civil rights protests. So this week I want to tell you more about those protests. If you weren't familiar with them, didn't realize they happened. I know I wasn't familiar with them. My main source for this episode is a joint memoir between a mother and a daughter titled Freedom in the Family, a mother-daughter memoir of the fight for civil rights by Patricia Stevens Due and Tanana Reeve Due. Of all the books I've read for research, I have to say that this book is by far my favorite. Personally, I love memoirs. And this one is beautifully written. It's a page turner. It's so easy to read. Like, both women are expert storytellers, and they've definitely lived rich lives. And I do end up using a lot of direct quotes from her in this story, so bear with me. I just feel that her words are a lot more impactful than me paraphrasing them. So,
I'm here for it.
The story I'm focusing on today is literally just a few chapters of Patricia's life. There's so much more to her life. So I urge you, if you're interested, to give the book a read. Again, it's called Freedom in the Family, a mother-daughter memoir of the fight for civil rights. If you like memoirs, highly recommend it. It
sounds very cool.
It's really good. I've cried so many times reading it. It's just like,
oh man,
they're really good writers.
I have some friends that we've started up a book club, so I might have to recommend this one to them.
Oh yeah, yeah, I definitely recommend it.
We'll definitely, we should leave a link for it too when we, well, we do on our website always.
Yeah, but it'll be in the sources, and probably post a picture of the cover on the Instagram. So let's begin. Patricia Stevens was born in the small rural town outside of Quincy, Florida in 1933. As a girl, she always acted a little older than her age, a little more self-sufficient than other kids, and very bright. She liked to play, go fishing, laugh, and listen to music as much as any of her friends, but there was always something under the surface. In her memoir, she describes it as a switch in her head that wouldn't allow her to ignore injustice when she saw it. Quote, "There are many times I've wished I could turn that switch off, but that's not the way it works. It's on. It always has been and it always will be. I've learned to accept that." Her town was a farm community of long-standing black families, and at the time, her school was segregated. She writes that as a child, she didn't even know any white people, and she never really questioned that. When she was about 9, her mother remarried, and the family moved to a town in South Florida called Belle Glade. This was where she first became aware of the racial differences around her. And, she writes, she learned to rebel early. When she was around 13, Patricia and her sister Priscilla would walk up to the Dairy Queen for some ice cream. The store had two windows, one marked white and one marked colored around the back. The sisters didn't see any reason why they shouldn't be served at the window that most of the other customers were standing at. And they knew that the window around back was much more neglected and that they wouldn't get the same standard of service as the window for whites. Patricia wasn't concerned with signs like that. She knew that they were as good as any other paying customers, so when they went to the, so they ended up going to the white window every time. At first, the man working the counter would tell them that they were at the wrong window, as if he thought they didn't know how to read. She writes, "When he realized we did know the difference and we were just there flashing our sweetest smiles with no intention of moving, he got irritated. But he served us. If we had been adults, it probably would have been a different story. Someone might have called the police."
Wow.
So clearly, Patricia was strong-willed and pushed back even when others went along with the way things were. When she was 15, a white mailman made a sexual advance on her while she was volunteering as a greeter at her school. She was rightfully appalled and angry and immediately sought help from her stepfather, who was the dean of students at her school. However, he hesitated. And it was then, she writes, that she first began to notice the volatility of race in her community. Quote, looking back on it now, I think Daddy Marion, her stepfather, was afraid we would be visited by misfortune if we stirred up trouble. And men, of course, usually had to bear the brunt of retribution in the South. So I understand why he hesitated. But for my mother, fear of repercussions was the last thing on her mind. When her mother heard what happened, she immediately called to report the man's actions and file a formal report with his work.
Wow. Go, Mom.
I know.
Oh, my God.
And, like, that's a very scary situation.
Yes.
For a 15-year-old, you're at your school, literally just greeting visitors, and a full-grown-ass white man hits on you. It's disgusting, and horrifying, and her reaction... Her reaction was to get mad, and I respect that. And, yeah, you know, her mom, too. Her mom was not going to have that shit. So they didn't actually hear anything back for a really long time. In fact, they didn't hear anything at all for a year.
Oh, my God.
But it turns out that the mailman in question had been harassing white women as well. And those reports were what motivated a full investigation into the guy.
Of course, yeah, because...
Yeah. An investigator did come to Patricia's house, but he was really hostile towards her and constantly tried to poke holes in her story, because by the time he came to her house, she was 16, but the report said she was 15. So he's like, well, were you lying about your, you know, like, and she's like, no, I was 15. It's been a year.
You haven't looked into my case for a year, so.
Exactly. And so she stood her ground, and her mom did too. Her mom had her back. So the investigation ended, and the mailman was fired.
Oh, thank God.
I know. Oh. I'm, like, pretty impressed, because, like, today people aren't even getting fired for doing shit like that.
No.
So good for her. And for her, it was a really formative experience. She hadn't backed down, and she saw that justice was served. She writes, quote, it was a lesson I would draw upon again and again as I became a young woman. I didn't know it then, but refusing to back down would become a trademark in my life. So I love that.
Wow.
that's her
TM
trademark. I don't back down.
You know what? That's amazing.
Yeah. So that's a little bit of a background for Patricia, giving you an idea of a little bit of an idea of what her childhood was like, but I'm going to fast forward to the summer of 1959. Patricia and her sister Priscilla were students at Florida A&M University, and they spent that summer in Miami visiting their biological father. While there, a family friend invited them to a meeting of an organization called the Congress of Racial Equality, or CORE. So CORE was a nonviolent interracial civil rights organization, and they were holding meetings to train people on a strategy for change. Patricia writes, quote, CORE had a plan. The organization had developed techniques for direct action, such as sit-ins, where interracial groups of protesters sat in public places to protest discriminatory policies. And they had a very specific protocol for how its protests should be carried out. They were to be nonviolent. CORE taught you that you must try to destroy a system, not an individual, based on Gandhian principles of nonviolent protest. It all made perfect sense to me, end quote. So that sounds familiar if you know a little bit about the civil rights movement.
Yes, very familiar.
It is kind of the foundation for civil disobedience.
It's all during this time. It's what's happening.
Yeah, and this was a very new thing.
Even here in Florida. Mm-hmm. Here in Florida.
Yeah, this was in Miami. And it was a very new concept at the time. And Patricia was impressed by how many white people were there and how many there were Jewish activists there. She was, like, very excited by the fact that there could be a collaboration, and she felt that that would make the movement even more powerful.
Yeah.
So they were energized They were energized with a plan from CORE, something that they could do and teach others to do, to try and make a change. It had been 8 years since the murder of Harry and Harriet Moore by 1959, and 5 years since the Supreme Court ruled to desegregate schools, Brown versus the Board of Education, which the South was still largely ignoring. So I don't know if you know, but the South did not desegregate when the Supreme Court passed that law. And in fact, some schools didn't desegregate in the South until the 70s.
It's insane.
There was violence against Black people across the whole South. And just before school let out for the summer, a student at Florida A&M was forced from her car at gunpoint by four white men and raped 7 times.
Oh my God.
The shock and pain of that crime was still resonating with the FAMU students when they got back to school that fall. And the sisters, Patricia, just 19 at the time, decided to start the Tallahassee chapter of CORE.
Wow. It's time. Yes. It's time.
Exactly.
She's like, this needs to stop. This needs to change. That's amazing.
They wanted to do something. And as soon as the students began to trickle back to campus, she writes, the sisters began knocking on dormitory doors. We must have talked to 100 people, maybe more. CORE was an unknown organization at FAMU and in Tallahassee, but the students we talked to seemed eager to use the techniques used by CORE to eradicate a system that robbed them of their dignity and first-class citizenship. Adults in the community also joined the cause. Local ministers provided guidance and opened up their churches as meeting spaces, while school administrators and professors at FAMU helped students make connections with other local groups working for civil rights and justice. That spring, on February 1st, 1960, the student sit-in movement was born when four young men from Greensboro sat at a lunch counter at Woolworth in Greensboro. So that was the first sit-in.
Wow.
At Greensboro, at Woolworth. And if you don't know, because I didn't, what Woolworth was, it was a department store that also served food at a lunch counter. So I think kind of how, like, Sam's Club has hot dogs and stuff. I think it's kind of like that.
I feel like it's different than Sam's Club.
Yeah, but it's weird to think about a lunch counter in a department store. But yeah, that's you know, a small lunch counter.
In London, they have a store called Harrods.
Mm-hmm.
And like that, they have like an amazing like food court. But that's not here.
But it that might be similar,
it,
yeah.
It might be, but like they literally have like all types of food. And it's like buffet style. They have from pressed juices. It's kind of fancy and bougie, but you like you can eat lunch there and then shop. But I'm sure that was the idea behind the same thing with this store.
Yeah, exactly. You can shop and eat at the same time. But it was segregated and Black people couldn't sit at the lunch counter. And so these students in Greensboro were told to move to the quote colored section, but they didn't.
Wow.
They sat and they read their books. And when the store closed for the night, they left, promising to return the next day with more students from their school. This simple act of defiance to a corrupt system sparked an energy in cities across the South. Patricia and the other CORE members wanted to support the Greensboro students by sitting in too. At this point, the group had spent months documenting all of the discriminating policies in the city, not just limited to lunch counters, but with the catalyst of Greensboro, their local Woolworth was the perfect place to start. And let me clarify, because I will talk about students from various schools, but Florida A&M at the time was a Black university and FSU was a white university. So if I'm talking about Florida A&M students, I'm talking about Black students, and FSU students are going to be white for your context. So, like I was saying, Woolworth is where they were going to start the first sit-ins in Tallahassee. On February 13th, Patricia and 9 other students walked calmly into Woolworth's store on Monroe Street. Dressed in neat school attire, they carried their school books to the lunch counter, sat down, and each ordered a slice of cake. The waitress refused to serve them, but the students remained seated. One by one, the white patrons began to leave, only a few staying to finish their meals. It was quiet for a time, but then a different crowd began to grow. Shoppers at the store gathered around and started making threats, taunting, calling the students slurs and other hateful things. And the whole time, the students sat silently looking at their books. But, Patricia writes, quote, "None of us could pay real attention to the words on our book's pages. I even saw someone holding a small handgun, which was shocking. And no one said a word to him about putting the gun away, even inside a public store. Was he going to shoot us? We had entered new, dangerous territory." The crowd became more and more antagonistic, and the threats intensified, Patricia writes. The store manager panicked and closed the counter. So the core members left after spending 2 hours at the lunch counter. This reaction comes from 9 young people sitting down at a lunch counter. Just to give you an idea of the atmosphere of Tallahassee in the South at the time, that was enough to create a small mob of people getting pissed off in a store.
So yeah. And even like someone to pull a gun, like they
exactly. But the core members saw that as a success, and it was, because it made a point. They sat there silently and made their statement. Patricia took what she learned from that experience, along with what she was trained on at the core workshop in Miami, and planned for the next sit-in demonstration. This time, 2 white students from Florida State would act as observers. The plan was that they would arrive first and sit at the lunch counter. Most importantly, they would remain seated once the black students sat down, Patricia writes. Quote, "We hoped that we would demonstrate through example that there was nothing earth-shattering about Negroes and whites sitting next to each other." She writes, quote, "They would also report that what was said about us after we left. This is just one of the many ways interracial cooperation was so important to the movement," end quote. So this was Core's idea, and this is a part of their plan. You know, that's the part of the general Core plan that they set out. Having white people come in, not as participators, but as observers. And also, it helps to make a visual point. Another very important addition was a local 43-year-old resident, Mary Ola Gaines, who was joining the students at the sit-in. As an adult, an established member of the Black community in Tallahassee, Patricia felt that she lended even more legitimacy to the cause. "Now," Patricia writes, "no one would be able to dismiss us as so-called outside agitators." So at the time, reporters and government officials would try to delegitimize protests by making the claim that people demonstrating were from out of town and not genuine members of the community. I don't know if that sounds familiar to you at all.
Sounds very familiar.
So that was a strategy that government officials were using even then to delegitimize. So she was excited that they had this older woman with them, who no one could say was an outside agitator, supporting them. And Mary Gaines was not a part of CORE. That was like really a student organization. But she just felt that she was doing the right thing. So Saturday, February 20th, their group of 17 people arrived at Woolworth around 2 p.m. Once again, they sat down at the lunch counter to order. The other white patrons quickly left, leaving only the sit-in participants and 2 white observers. This time, a large crowd grew quicker than before, shouting angrily. Patricia writes, quote, "We could feel the rage swelling behind us. Out of the corner of my eye, I noticed a man holding a baseball bat. The hoodlums who'd gathered around us were mostly younger men with upturned shirt collars, many of them wearing their hair slicked back in the style of the day. The crowd had become very big, very fast. I felt someone tug sharply on my clothing, but I sat stoically, not moving. The hoodlums were trying to pull us from the stools, trying to provoke us. But every single one of us held ourselves in check. We sat and read, all while knowing that no one was likely to step forward to stop it if we were attacked.
Just so brave. And just the power of example, like, I guess the having the two FSU students there didn't even faze them. They just automatically assumed that, I don't know. I don't know what happens next, but it's just, it's, wow.
I mean, it's powerful. It's such a simple action.
Mm-hmm.
And yet garners such an extreme response. And at the time, they were using that effectiveness, that, like, contrast between people who were sitting stoically versus people who were, you know, raging and threatening and calling people slurs and stuff. So that was this new tactic at the time that they were using. So after about 45 minutes, the tension was high. The two white observers decided to leave, and soon after, the mayor of Tallahassee came into the store with other members of the city commission to ask them to leave.
Oh, God.
So Patricia was not impressed by this. She said, quote, "As long as he led a city with segregated policies, he had not won my respect," which is dope. Because, yeah, I mean, that's clearly just a publicity stunt.
Yeah.
That the mayor comes down.
Yeah, we're like, we need to get the mayor down here to break this up, so.
So some students did leave after that, but 11 remained, including Mrs. Gaines. By 3:30 p.m., so they got there at 2, so an hour and a half later, the police arrived. And Priscilla, who was the designated spokesperson, calmly told the police that they would not leave until they were served. All 11 demonstrators were arrested for disturbing the peace by, quote, engaging in riotous conduct.
Oh, yeah. Quote. So riotous. What the hell?
So interesting that the people sitting at the lunch counter were engaging in riotous conduct and not the mob of angry white people yelling at them.
With baseball bats. Yeah.
With baseball bats. Not them. They're not the right. Like, I mean, it's such a. And Patricia writes about how, like, at the time she was so frustrated because it's clearly meaningless and mm-hmm. she wanted to have faith in the justice system as something that works. But she's seeing firsthand that it doesn't and it's biased and it's unjust.
Yep.
But that's not the end of the story. Their arrests are not the end of the story. The ALCU provided lawyers, and the NAACP helped pay their bonds, so they were out on bond until their trial.
Wow.
And by that time, about 200 black students in 38 cities across the South had been arrested in demonstrations. So this was a mass movement that was starting, and it was building. CORE had tried to negotiate with Woolworth and the other stores in the area, but they would not change their segregated policies. CORE decided to stage sit-ins at two stores on March 12th, just a couple weeks after Patricia's arrest. Quote, "Students were angry that other students had actually been arrested for simply trying to order food," Patricia writes. And since negotiations with the store managers had failed, dozens had volunteered to take part in the sit-ins scheduled that day, end quote. So, basically, it was a wake-up call for, I think, a lot of young people living in Tallahassee at the time. A lot of white students at FSU who kind of, even at the time, didn't think, you know, like now, thought that, you know, everything was cool. Thought that separate but equal was a thing, or didn't realize the extent to which segregation spread because it didn't affect them mm-hmm. personally, right? So all of these white students didn't realize didn't look around and see how the Black people in their community were being treated. They're saying, well, they're just university students too. And then suddenly something so simple as not being allowed to eat cake at a lunch counter gets people arrested. And it kind of shows the insanity at which the justice system functioned, because they're not, that's not a criminal act. And in fact, they weren't even because of the way the Jim Crow laws worked, they're not being arrested for not sitting in the colored section. They're being arrested for creating a disturbance,
yeah, you know, for exactly not complying with the system. Yeah,
exactly. So it kind of woke a lot of people up, a lot of white people up anyways. And they joined, FSU students joined FAMU students and CORE in the protests. So the sit-ins went the same way that they had on February 20th. 12 students from both FAMU and FSU were arrested and taken directly to jail. A crowd of whites had formed outside the store, jeering and yelling. But this time, more people were ready to pick up where the first students left off. Back at FAMU, CORE sent 50 more students to take over for those arrested at Woolworth, and 50 to sit in with the students at McRoy's, the other store. So the students who went to McRoy's were arrested as soon as they arrived. But at Woolworth, a literal mob of armed whites had assembled to stop more students from entering the store. Students held their ground and shouted, "No violence, no violence," as the mob of white people brandishing baseball bats, knives, and axe handles grew. The police officers on the ground refused to do anything about the mob of people threatening the group of students. The students returned to campus to report to CORE what was going on. Patricia writes, quote, "We got the word out to everyone who would listen and made placards in support of our arrested students. The signs read, 'No violence. We will not fight mobs. We are Americans too. Give us back our students.' Standing on the steps between the stately columns of Jackson Davis Hall on FAMU's campus, I bared my heart and soul to my fellow students as I described the arrest of our classmates, and the students responded," Patricia writes. "Before long, our number had swelled to 1,000 strong. With our placards painted and our spirits buoyed, we began a peaceful march, walking in pairs that stretched in a seemingly endless line," end quote. And there are photos on Florida Memory, and we'll post them on the Instagram, of this protest, of the signs, of the line of students side by side marching. They intended to march from FAMU campus to downtown Tallahassee, but they never made it. Near the railroad tracks that divide Tallahassee, dozens of police officers formed a barrier along two streets. As soon as the protesters got close enough, the police officers began throwing tear gas bombs into the crowd. This is Patricia's firsthand account. Quote, "I will never forget how one police officer, who apparently recognized me as one of the student leaders, stood directly in front of me and said, 'I want you,' before lobbing a tear gas canister into my face point blank. The thick, bitter chemicals filled my eyes, nose, and mouth. I coughed and choked, flailing and blinded as the other students around me screamed and fled. For a terrifying instant, I could not breathe at all. My eyes were afire," end quote.
Oh my God. In ways, it sounds a lot very familiar to stuff that's happening right now.
Yes, it does. And that, this was 1960.
Yeah, and that's something in itself just so heartbreaking. And just the fact that, like, people now and back then are being so brave to peacefully protest and are being turned away just because of whatever orders were given, you know. It's,
yeah, it sounds, I mean, it's, it sounds like very little has changed, if anything at all.
This is back in what year?
1960.
2020. Like, why does this sound the same?
Yeah. Yeah, and I'll continue with her her account. Basically, like we were saying, it was havoc. The protesters were boxed in with very few places to run to. But Patricia was able to take shelter in a nearby church with several protesters. Quote, "All around me, as I sat blinded in that church, I heard my schoolmates straggling in, sobbing. Their clothes reeked of tear gas. Many were treated for burns and other injuries at the FAMU hospital, rescued from the scene by faculty members. Later, I heard reports that police had actually blocked the path of students trying to run back towards campus during the tear gas attack. 35 demonstrators were arrested, although the police did nothing to punish the armed whites who began using violence against the students. Clearly, the Tallahassee authorities considered it their job only to protect the interests of segregationist whites, not the interest of peace. Our own nation, it seemed, was at war against us." End quote.
Heavy.
Yes, and that's a striking picture. You can visualize it, particularly because there are the same visuals in the news right now. Protesters getting
absolutely
boxed in, police doing nothing to stop violence against protesters. So, because of the injury that Patricia sustained from the tear gas, her sight has never been the same. Her eyes have so much light sensitivity that she has to wear dark glasses at all times.
Wow.
Just 5 days later, Patricia, Priscilla, and the 9 others who were present during the very first sit-in at Woolworth earlier in February went on trial for their charge of, quote, disturbing the peace and engaging in riotous behavior. So if you remember, the very first students who got arrested are now going on trial. They were all found guilty and faced a fine of $300 or 60 days in jail. The sisters and 6 others refused to pay the fine. They didn't want to pay money that would support an unjust system. They decided instead to take their time in jail. This surprised the whole community. Everyone had expected that they would be convicted, pay the money, and end it there. Basically saying, yep, you'll take your punishment and then move on. But this act of resistance became known as the first, quote, jail-in. The sit-in became a jail-in. They pioneered this tactic, where activists refused to pay fines for laws that they considered unjust and morally reprehensible.
Ugh, that's insane. I can't believe this is what started that movement, at least that part of the movement.
Yes, they pioneered it. This is the first ever jail-in.
I'm not going to pay for this injustice. I'm going to sit here and you're going to pay for me to be in the jail for 60 days because it's like backwards how that has to happen. But the powerful meaning behind it is just so, wow, I didn't know that.
Yes. Yeah. And no, me neither. I never knew that. And it's so impactful. And also, it tells the world how precious this cause is to them, how dire it is that they are willing, because also, I mean, in prison, they're not going to be safe. You know, they're going to be, and in her memoir, Patricia writes about the, you know, the environment in prison and how abusive and awful it was. So you can read more about that in her memoir. But yeah, you're willing to say, you're going to say, I'm willing to sustain this abuse because I will not give money to an unjust system.
Yeah.
You know,
it's just about not complying. It's.
Yeah, it is. Yeah.
If something is wrong and you just know that it's in your heart and like that it is unjust, and just sticking it to the man, honestly. That's so brave.
Yeah, it's very powerful. And these young women, I mean, literally, like, at this point, 20, 19?
Insane.
Really, really incredible. And their actions were met with a massive amount of support from the activist community. The sisters received a letter from Martin Luther King Jr.
Wow.
In jail, encouraging their protest. Hundreds of Tallahassee residents came to the jail to encourage them and sing songs outside. Famous baseball player Jackie Robinson brought them even more national attention by publishing Patricia's letter in his column in the New York Post. So Patricia and Priscilla served 49 days of their 60-day sentence in prison, with time off for good behavior. Once released, the sisters went on a national speaking tour, mostly to educate people in the North about what was really going on in the South. And they said that they found on this tour that people were really ignorant and people were constantly shocked and surprised by their story. And basically kind of living in blissful ignorance in the North because they didn't have to see it and they didn't have to interact with it, you know?
Yeah.
So it was an important kind of trip that they went on educating people.
Yeah. And stuff like this was so important back then, because even more so than today, even though there still is some information that's not being shared where it needs to be.
Yeah.
This is the only way, through newspapers, through talks.
Yeah. They actually had to go for people. They had to go up there. Yeah.
Exactly.
It's so true. No internet, no social media,
no Google. Crazy.
So, however, the battle was far from over. Patricia would be arrested several more times during sit-ins at lunch counters in Tallahassee. And it wouldn't be until 1963 that Tallahassee would fully integrate their lunch counters, even after other parts of the state had already complied. In the fight for civil rights, every battle was a separate one. Patricia writes, Patricia and Cor went on to picket segregated movie theaters, public swimming pools, anything they could do to keep the city moving towards full integration. As I said in the beginning, the lunch counter sit-ins were just a few chapters of Patricia's life, but her actions were critical in pioneering key tactics that the student movement would continue to use for years. Once again, I find myself learning about pivotal moments in civil rights history that happened in Florida only now as an adult, because we never learned about it in school, like we talked about in the beginning. Mm-hmm. And that was not an accident. It wasn't something that slid through the cracks. The choice to exclude these pivotal civil rights moments from our education was by design. And in fact, Patricia writes in her book, she was on... You know, she had, like I said, a rich life. So she was on a textbook committee, you know, planning the future of civil rights education, and was basically told, well, nothing really happened in Florida of note. And she was like, well, I was there. Oh, I lived it. But as she says, history is made by those who write it.
Seriously.
So now it's our responsibility and our privilege to educate ourselves. Peninsula Obscura is about uncovering Florida's secrets, and sometimes that means talking about chupacabras, and other times that means talking about the history that those in power would rather have people forget. This story is just one example of how police violence against people of color is deeply rooted in American history. Watching the protests going on now, it's striking to see the similarities. From the brutal and unwarranted use of tear gas and violence, to the attempt to delegitimize protesters, to the complete unwillingness to stop white people who show up and threaten demonstrators with weapons. Just as the fight continued for Patricia after Tallahassee integrated its lunch counters, the fight will continue for all of us, and I hope to see you there.
Yes, Karina. Like a snap. It snaps for you. Honestly, though, so well said. Are we going to rewrite this history ignoring the fact that all of this happened? Fucking no. Like, I'm over it.
Patricia, Stevens do go through all of this for us to sit idly by.
Yeah.
Like, these, her and so many others laid the groundwork.
History, I feel like, becomes more interesting to people when it's something that they can relate to.
Mm-hmm.
We love history. We love learning about stuff in the past. But I think just to know that, like, people that don't actively reach out for history aren't even getting it in their education, like, they're gonna miss it entirely. So, like, I keep saying that I'm excited about the fact that we're actually, like, taking a look back and we're trying to pull these stories back into curriculums and back into the forefront of history is just, like, very exciting for me. I am privileged to not have lived in, like, this era, but I'm living in this era and I want these stories. Like, I want my kids, I want my grandkids to know Patricia. I want people to understand how looking back at history can teach us so much, and the fact that we are repeating history means that we have not learned the lessons from the past, and that this story, perfect example of that.
And I will say, I was really frustrated because we found these pictures of the Tallahassee protests. So I decided to, you know, we there's a really striking image of Patricia Stevens Do with all of these articles about her around her face, and we're going to share that on the Instagram. And so Rachel found that picture, and I was like, who? We don't even know who this is.
Yes.
I try and do some research into her. Every article about her is, like, you know, a couple paragraphs, and I'm like, there is more to this story, clearly. And the only way I could find it is by fucking buying her memoir and reading it, because no one else is writing it. She just had to tell her own story and put it out there. I mean, so, you know, it's just, it's frustrating because there's not these resources, and these people's stories aren't being heard. So hopefully we can amplify it, and do go read her book that she wrote with her daughter, because it's beautiful and really interesting. Absolutely.
I need to, that's on my list. I feel in myself, I have had some introspection on the fact that my education is lacking. And yes, I went through my undergrad, and that is the level of education I have, and I don't know about these things. Kareen and I are constantly learning with stories that we tell each other on this podcast, but the fact that we didn't know about Patricia Stevens Do, or the fact that next week's episode I completely dismissed, like, at this, I'll tell you next week, but okay. Essentially, it's another story that was kind of not dismissed, but I didn't know the full extent to it. We know the Florida history of the white pioneers settling Florida, but what about the people who had been here just as long or even longer, you know?
Yeah, and exactly. Their story should not be forgotten. So
exactly.
So yeah. We're going to keep doing research. And hey, if you come across something and you want us to dig into it more, we'll do it. I mean,
yes.
The amount of fucking books I will read. I've already, you know, I love a book. So, I would say thank you for listening.
Yes, thank you, for listening. And we know that as people who are privileged, that it is our privilege to tell these stories. And even though we may not understand or ever will understand how it feels to be in these people's shoes, we stand with the stuff that we share, and we hope that everyone benefits from whatever we share. We're not like saints or anything, so we're gonna
I do think, like you said, like we can't know what it was like to be in these people's shoes, but hearing their stories is as close as you can get. Mm-hmm. And it, you know, you gain some perspective every time.
Absolutely.
So,
well,
okay.
That was great. That was great, Karina. Thank you for telling that story. I guess it's an ongoing story.
Thank you to Patricia Stevens Due for living it and writing it.
Yes, thank you, Patricia and her sister.
Yeah.
And everyone else in the civil rights movement and everyone out there today working at the movement that's happening now.
Yeah. I'll see you guys. I'll hope to see you guys out there.
Yes.
All right. Too. Well, that's it. So stop listening.
Stop listening.
All the music for our podcast is provided by The Murmurs and their album Get Swell Soon. You can listen to The Murmurs on Spotify or find them on their Bandcamp page.
If you're interested in learning more about us, you can visit our website at peninsulaobscura.com and check out our Instagram at peninsulaobscura. You can listen to our podcast on most platforms, including Spotify and Apple Podcasts.